marketing consists of multiple pillars. There's a demand generation pillar, product marketing, content, BDR, customer marketing. I was lucky because I work in all these pillars individually. That helps me create a great trust between me and the team members, because if there's a BDR I'm talking to, I know, because I was in their shoes like a couple of years ago.
Hi, I'm Nils Vinya, and you're listening to the B2B Leadership Podcast, a show dedicated to demystifying leadership development one conversation at a time. Each week, I sit down with leaders in the B2B space to discuss their journey and what they've learned along the way. This podcast is brought to you by the B2B Leaders Academy. The cost of not consistently developing your leadership skills is enormous, and the B2B Leaders Academy features monthly leadership training and live coaching. Being a great leader isn't hard. You just need a guide and the right set of tools. So head on over to b2bleadersacademy.com to join and become the leader you have always wanted to be. Hello and welcome to another episode of the B2B Leadership Podcast. My name is Nils Vinya, and today my guest is John Ozdurk. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nils, for having me today. I look forward to our conversation today.
Oh, same here. I can't wait to dig in. But first, John, if you could share with me and this audience the role that you're in today and the company that you work for.
I'm at VP of Marketing in a company called Netomi. We are doing AI for customer support, and I'm running the marketing department for last 3 years.
All right. Okay. So VP of Marketing, AI company, focus on customer support. Let's tear that apart a little bit. What's the problem that you're solving in the customer support world with AI?
So I think we are all our customers, right? I'm sure you have been talking to your airline when you are going to East Coast like last week, right? There's always a problem whether you have a telecom carrier or airline or anything. And there is so much demand for real-time resolution. What we happen is that we don't have any luxury. We don't have any patience. When you are waiting for your next airline and when it is delayed, you want to talk to somebody right away. What's happening today is that the agents are overstaffed, they are overworked, and they don't have the time to answer all of us real time. The one-way solution is that you can hire 10x more people, which is not costly for like companies like the airlines or telecommunication companies or food delivery companies. What we do is that we make sure everybody's question answers real time. We have a patented AI that we understand the intent of the customer question, and we try to solve as quickly as possible. We don't communicate to solve all the problems. We solve the very easy questions, reduce the like burden on the customer agents. And for the like tougher questions, we create the answer and we ask human agents to click send or edit as they like it. And we continuously learn how the human agent solved the question. Eventually, we improve the automation. We start around like 20% automation and go all the way to 8% automation in the next couple of years.
Wow. We always, oftentimes, when it comes to AI, we hear about training the algorithms, right? To give them more data, more insight, more to better make decisions. But some of your training is actually live with the agents where it's presenting what it thinks first and then asking the agents, does this work? And after they provide as many feedback samples as they can, then it gets smarter. And that's some of the live, the actual training of the models. Is that right?
That's 100% correct. We have two types of training. One is, as you mentioned, reinforcement training based on what we learn from the human agents. But we also start with the kickstart by the studying the company's historical data. For example, before we start, we'll ask our company's last 6 months or last 1 year of data. That's how we start initial 20%. But eventually, we continue to like try to listen in to understand how the humans solve so that we can improve our automation percentage every single day.
That's cool. You know, and to the point you made about everybody wants a response now, like especially in travel, right? And when something doesn't go right and whatnot. And there's nothing quite as infuriating as knowing that there's a bot on the other side, but also knowing that it has a very strict, rigid structure that only if you type in certain keywords, it will only give you certain results. And so I imagine you're providing a little bit of a different experience because you're there's some context to the problems that you're solving, and then you're routing to an actual physical person to get the more in-depth or more challenging questions resolved. Is that right?
Yeah. That's what the frustration happens, right? Like sometimes the first generation of chatbots, they try to solve everything. And then when you see that you are talking chatbot at that price. So we are honest with the customers and our customers' customers. When we are not certain, we don't try to solve it. We just propose the template and ask the human to like work on that, or like they most of the time accept, but sometimes they edit. So we continue to learn. So we reduce the frustration, which is the biggest part in customer support, because as we are customers, we always want to make sure whatever our, there's a reason we reach out to like customer support. There's a frustrated employees. We want to make sure that frustration is lower as possible.
That's right. Nobody ever reaches out to support when they don't have a problem.
Yes. Right? Yes.
You can pretty much be guaranteed that there is a frustration on the other end of that, whether it's a ticket, a chat, email, whatever it is, there's some frustration and it doesn't always come through in the most, you know, cohesive and nice manner. But if it's dealt with in a empathetic way, or at least an understanding kind of way, or there's some level of emotional intelligence that can be communicated and appreciation of the situation the individual is in, then that can completely de-escalate that frustration and tension with the individuals.
Yes, you got it correctly. And the good thing about AI is that AI doesn't have any emotions, right?
Yeah,
for most of the time, we can get personal, like, because think about that. You talk to a very angry customer, and then another customer is angry for another reason. And think about that. You are doing that entire 8 hours, like 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And also, some of the agents are restricted to do like basic things like copy-paste, because companies restrict them to be unique to each customer. So even though people ask the same question, for example, where is my order? Where is my order?
Yeah.
Where is my order? You cannot copy-paste. You have to start initiation. So at one point, these agents, human agents we call, get very frustrated, and they actually have big turnover. Actually, agent turnover is a big problem in customer support. But when AI comes, AI has no emotions. I'm saying that in a neutral way. AI has no emotions, which is a good thing, because we continuously deliver. It doesn't matter how frustrated the customer is, because at the end, we solve the question.
That's awesome. And then the questions that the agents do get to get involved with are actually meaningful and not something simple and mundane and routine, right? It actually takes a little bit of brain power to figure out how can I fix this and give the customer a great experience.
And that's give them a job satisfaction, right? Because if they think about all the mundane tasks, it is a boring thing. But if they only work very, very difficult questions that requires human to talk to like a couple of other people and look at other files and everything, that's really like satisfying job. So we keep the like low hanging fruits, and then we give the like high end fruits to all the like human agents to solve.
Cool. That sounds wonderful. All right. Awesome. So let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about leadership. You are VP of marketing today, but I know that wasn't always the case. That wasn't always your role. So would you share with me and our audience, how did you get into your very first leadership position?
Yeah, I think thank you very much for asking that question. Indeed, I was not always a VP of marketing. I believe that there's a title that's called leadership, but even before I was, if you look about my first leadership role, it was at NVIDIA. But before at NVIDIA, when I was an engineer, I was always coaching and influencing my peers, and I was always like cheerleader for the project. So I was always influencing their decisions. But let me talk about NVIDIA, because that's the answer to your question. When I joined NVIDIA, I joined its high-performance computing group. It was before NVIDIA was so popular. At that time when I joined, NVIDIA was only known for GPUs, or known as graphic processing units. And my group was responsible to bring these GPUs into high-performance computing. So it was the early phases of the like the industry, and we were only selling to the big institutions, supercomputing centers, universities, right? So companies who were using that were academics mostly. Like they were in very complex sections like fluid dynamics, computation, structural mechanics, molecular biology. These are the people who needed a GPU, because their simulations or work were taking days, if not weeks. When we were using GPUs, it was getting reduced to smaller groups. So that's what one of my first role, and that's the first time I manage a couple of people.
Now, you were on the engineering side, right? So, and very technical stuff, as we're talking about GPUs and the chips and NVIDIA, all kinds of super deep technical stuff. How did you navigate the transition from going from individual contributor on the engineering side to then getting into a position where you were responsible for people and a team?
Yeah, I think one thing that helped me is that I have a slightly different background than some of the other VP marketing, because I work years as an engineer. Like I know the technical domain, so I can comfortably talk about GPU and its background for a while. So that was an easy transition for me to understand, I think, the technology. So I worked for years as the engineer and then switched to NVIDIA, where I can use my technical knowledge into product marketing. And to answer your question, I think I was able to generate results, for example, in NVIDIA when I hired first couple of interns. We generate results. I create a program called GPU Test Drive, where people remotely join to access my servers, where they can see CPU-only products and CPU plus GPU, and they can see the volume. And at the end of the like couple of months of test drive, we have people see that instead of 24 hours of simulation, if they log into GPU system, they can finish that in like 2 hours, 10x improvement. And that was a big opportunity. That's why we sold, I don't think I can say the exact number, but I can easily say that we sold thousands of GPUs in a month or so, which means that I was actually very, it made me successful because I was running that campaign. And throughout that, I mean, then other people reach out to me, then they said, hey, do you want to run our marketing department? And then that's how it brought up to my current role at Netomi.
Huh. Okay, so the difference between the engineering world and the marketing world, I want to take that lens from a leadership perspective. How do you think, you know, you shared some very detailed stuff of that you approach the world differently because you have a background in engineering, but how does that apply to the work that you do running the marketing team at Netomi?
I think there are lots of parallels between engineering and marketing because I use some of the transferable skills. One thing I think I do good is that planning and operational skills. So because I think when I was doing anything alone, I was doing by myself. I was 100% individual contributor. But now I'm running a team of 23 people where I need to coach and manage them, but I also need to plan their activities. So I work with them throughout the months and quarters to make sure that they hit their goals. I think planning is something I learned throughout my experience. I was able to see, and we have a strict OKRs, objective and key results, that we religiously track and make sure that I set the right goals and make sure that I let them hit their goals. And I'm also a little bit lucky because I know you talk to other marketing people. Marketing consists of multiple pillars. There's a demand generation pillar, product marketing, content, BDR, customer marketing. I was lucky because I work in all these pillars individually. That helps me create a great trust between me and the team members. Because if there's a BDR I'm talking to, I know because I was in their shoes like a couple of years ago. If I'm talking to a demand generation person, I know because I was also demand generation. So it really gives me like enough confidence and they have confidence in me so we can work together. What's the right goal? I think goal setting, mm-hmm. And planning is the most important thing. And second is this, the operational thing, where I make sure that day by day, what the team does and individually what we achieve these goals.
Cool. All right. So if we can double click on the OKRs piece a little bit, and this is an area that some people, like you're describing, have tremendous success and use it to run the organization and run smoothly and like machine and clockwork, and it's all good. Other organizations have attempted, and to varying degrees of success, the OKR system. So we'd love to hear, you know, some of the tricks and things that you found to be most helpful to ensure that your OKRs are actually legit and real, and two, meaningful to the team, and three, you can present them to the company or stand behind them from an operational perspective. So how have you made OKRs a success inside your organization?
I think a couple of things I can say about OKRs. First of all, it has to be consistent with everybody else in the organization. You cannot run an OKR by yourself without getting a buy-in from the CEO or the board. And it has to be relevant to what you do. Sometimes I'm seeing that people are working hard and then on top of that, they say, okay, you have to also create an OKR. That OKR should be what you do. It should be aligning with what you do. What happens in early stage startups is that there is every day is a different challenge. So you don't know what to put. So you put some stuff and then you don't adjust it. What happens in our case is that, like, I've been doing OKRs last 3 years. And my first couple of quarters, I didn't hit the like numbers correctly because it was hard for me to forecast and like think what is right. But now I have enough data, I know what is doable and what is not doable. And I try to stretch it a little bit and make sure that everybody use like 90% of their times to hit on their OKRs. For example, I ask the team members to print out the OKRs that is their name is there, and then make sure that what you have done today to hit one of these OKRs today. Like if you are, it's good to help other departments or do your individual work, but OKRs is a priority. That's something very important that I set the priority, that you have to be making sure that OKRs are aligned and whatever you do is on the right OKR. I think once you set the OKRs, it is relevant and consistent. And once you get the buy-in from the employee, I think that is very doable. And we also try to increase our OKRs every quarter. There's always a little bit tension every time myself and the team member, like, are we increasing again? But that's how you grow as a company. Every month, every quarter, you have to increase so that you can grow as the company. And that so far, we have seen very good success. We hit 92% of the OKRs last quarter. And our goal is always hit 100%. But we also acknowledge that it's okay to miss one or two OKRs. It is not the end of the world. But we try to hit as much as possible, even though OKRs are increased from previous quarter.
We'll get back to the interview in just a minute. This episode is brought to you by the B2B Leaders Academy. The cost of not consistently developing your leadership skills is enormous. The B2B Leaders Academy features monthly leadership training and live coaching. Being a great leader isn't hard. You just need a guide and the right set of tools. Head on over to b2bleadersacademy.com to join and become the leader you've always wanted to be. Now let's get back to the interview.
Wow. Okay. So this wonderful, and one of the interesting things you said there is what I've observed as from the outside as a consultant, having been parts of lots of organizations, some of them with OKRs in place, some of them not so much, and having implemented and been part of this in some of my former companies long ago, was the fact that the first couple of quarters, you didn't hit it. And I think that's where a lot of friction happens and a lot of reasons why the OKR system as a whole doesn't get adopted. So how long did it actually take you and the organization to get past that initial, I don't know how to set the target just right, to get to the point where you could have confidence in hitting the target? And then every time you hit the target, you kind of want to set another target because it feels good. So how long was that process? Was this 2 quarters? Was this a year? Was it 18 months? Like, what was the time frame you were dealing with?
I think first 2 quarters, we were a little bit off. But a little bit off means that some of the targets where we thought we are stretch ourselves too thin. It was not doable. We learned that, right? And I think in 3rd quarter, we start to hit the like 90% number, because 90% is internal goal for myself. Early, it wasn't like we were off like 0%, but it was like 40 to 50% range, which is, yeah, I think, fine. But in 3rd quarter, we were either 90% or close to 90% of all the OKRs. But also it depends from department, because some departments, it takes a while. For example, in SEO, for example, part of the demand generation team, it takes for the Google or the other search engine to learn about yourself. Or in engineering, it takes build a new engineer and onboard, like, but to understand their capacity planning. Or in customer support, there are different metrics. So it, I think, depends from department. I think if somebody is not able to hit the OKR after 5 or 6 quarters, then something is off. I think I've seen people come right away and deliver. In my case, we missed the first 2 quarters, but 3rd quarter was a success. I think the rule of thumb might be like 2 to 4 quarters will be ideal for any kind of B2B SaaS companies.
Cool. 2 to 4 quarters, that definitely aligns with what I would see and what I experienced myself as well. Those first 2 quarters were a disaster. And you almost feel like a failure a little bit. You're like, wait a second, I've been planning and putting goals in place for a long time. How is it that I can completely miss this all of a sudden because we're in a new structure? But it happens, right? It's okay. Because you learn and you adjust, and then you get your targets better and you get your tracking better and you get your forecast better. And then by the 3rd quarter, like you guys, we're north of 90% accuracy on those. That's awesome. Yeah.
And I think it's all about, like, because I come from a little bit demand generation background, I'm a big believer of experimentation, like old A-B testing. So it's okay to understand what is wrong and then adjust it, right? So I'm always okay to, I know that if I run an A-B test, I know one of them will fail, right? We also have continuous experiments, and I know that half of them will not be successful. So similarly, as long as the only thing is that you have to study what did go wrong and then make the action to fix it for the next quarter. So that's why I'm saying like 2 to 4 is the ideal.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the mindset of experimentation, I think, is so important that you had out. And I love that your background, one, on the engineering side, and then background on marketing, I think gives us just such a good, solid understanding of, as you think of an A-B test, for anybody not familiar, that's just testing the same thing with two slightly different versions of it in order to figure out which one is going to be successful. The marketing world uses this all the time, but from a leadership perspective, there's no reason why you can't A-B test, you know, something within your team or something that is within your weekly team meeting or something that is within your monthly cadence of how you report out to the organization, right? There's all kinds of room for testing. And this is a great example on the OKR front that you've just shared with us.
Yeah. And also, I can also add that 100% agree with you. There are different OKRs for different companies. And also, there is not like one magic OKR that works for everybody. Or like even in marketing, for example, right? This is my fifth startup after NVIDIA. And every company, I have one different flagship campaign. In one company, it was SEO. The other one was trade show. In the other one, it's a webinar. So it's also, that's why we have to always experiment. And then I think identifying what works for you and then deliver on these things. And also, this can be applied to other roles, right? Like in sales, you can easily try different sales methods. And then whichever you close more, you can focus on that method, right? So you can always experiment. You don't need to be a marketer or engineer. Anybody can experiment and A-B test throughout their leadership journey, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, that's excellent. And the experiment A-B test, just have a hypothesis, right? Have an idea and then come up with some kind of test that might either prove it or disprove it. And any area of your leadership can do that. I'm curious about on the OKR front, tracking and executing to north of 90% of targets hit must require consistent focus and awareness for not only you, but the entire team and the whole organization and probably the company too, of where you are in relation to your OKRs throughout the quarter. So how do you keep this top of mind? Is every individual have their own OKR that rolls up? Are these team level OKRs that everybody just knows where you are in the quarter? Like, how do you make sure this becomes part of the fabric of the team and not just something that, well, we set it at the beginning of the quarter and then we, you know, report out at the end of the quarter?
When I first started, because I was the first employee at Netomi and I hired the first couple of people, it was everybody has an OKR. But now when we have 23 people, we changed the structure that only team leaders have an OKR because it will be difficult for me to track all of them, and team leaders make sure that their team is hitting that OKR. So these team leaders are responsible for that OKR. And what we do is that we do two things. We don't meet once a quarter. We meet at least three or four times a quarter to make sure that mostly at the end of the month to see what is missing, what else we can do from next 2 months, for example, as for each OKR. And then this is like all the team leaders join, all the marketing team leaders join, and then we transparently share, okay, of the like 30 OKRs, 20 is in good shape, but 10 is missing. So can we adjust some resources? Can we do some addition work? Do we need to get another tool? Do we need to use other resource? I can jump in. Or most of the time, I also help these areas because, again, I'm lucky because I was able to work in all these different pillars of marketing. I can always use my help from, I switch from my major to focus from product marketing to demand generation. Demand generation is missing, right? So that's one thing. And secondly, these monthly meetings really help us transparently. We show what is happening. Secondly, in my one-on-one with my team members, I always start them to talk about OKRs. Hey, what did you do this week about OKR? How are you feeling? Because there are some things we talk as a group, but some of them I want to make sure that we are hitting on the one-on-one level because OKR is one of our, like, I don't want to say Bible, but it's one of the things that we really want to hit. That's something that we want to achieve. And I also like connected everybody's bonuses and performance based on that one. So now they know that if they don't hit an OKR, they are not getting their bonuses. That's as clear as that. We all want to get our money, right? If you don't get your OKRs, then there's a reason you might not get some or all of your bonus.
Yeah, right. No, I love that. And there's no escaping it. It sounds like in your one-on-ones, which probably happen either weekly or biweekly, I imagine, right? You're bringing it up and making it a part of the conversation that just, you know, where are you in your OKRs? How are you doing? What are some of the blockers? And then on a monthly basis, what I heard you say was that your team leads, and you are meeting as a whole and group and looking at the OKRs across all the teams within your department. And then everybody gets a chance to either share what's working well or where they're struggling and get help from the others. Is that right?
Exactly, 100%. That is the methodology we found, it works for us. And as we grew, it worked for us as at 20, but as we grew to like 100 employees, we might need to change again. But currently, it works perfect for us. And our goal is to hit another 95 plus OKR this Q2.
That's wonderful. Okay. I'm curious about the, from the team leader's perspective, right? So they're responsible for hitting this OKR. And then you are having conversations on a monthly basis and even on a weekly basis with them about these OKRs. How do you measure whether or not or how well they are doing working with their teams to achieve this? Because you're managing managers who manage people. And sometimes when there's an layer in between you and the people who are on the ground doing the actual work, it'd be a little bit of a challenge to know exactly what's going on. And certainly the OKRs is an indicator, right? But sometimes there might be other things going on that you don't know because you're just not close enough in a team of 23 or 25 people. And as you continue to grow, so how do you as a leader stay close to the people who are several layers below you, even outside or I guess in conjunction with the OKR or outside of it?
Yeah. So first of all, I meet all of my direct reports at least once a week. Most of the time when there's a specific project, we have these daily meetings, but for at least I meet once a week. And everybody else I meet bi-weekly. Like, because it is, again, not a 100-person team. There is like only like 10-plus people who are not my direct reports. So I also meet with them once in 2 weeks. So I understand from both sides. Because sometimes it is the individual contributor's problem, to your point. Sometimes it is the manager. So I get a sense that who might be the reason, what might be the reason. That's sometimes both of the cases is the problem. So I make some adjustments. Sometimes we make some adjustments between the like employees. If we believe that employee is not good, we make some adjustments. But also, I always start by saying, as I forgot to mention, that we start by hiring the best of the best. So we have a very extensive interview process. My goal is to hire only one person of that specific function. If I'm hiring a product marketing manager, I want to make sure that she or he is the one person of her or his like pool. If I'm hiring a business development rep, he or she has to be one person of their level. Sometimes it is not easy because it takes a while to find these people. But once everybody is good, then it is very honest communication. And we mostly talk about not the finger pointing, but then how can we improve as a collective? So that is not a major problem that happened to us, that people are pointing fingers.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And so let me ask you about the balance between always wanting to hire the top 1%, totally get that. And even though it's going to take time, so you're willing to sacrifice time in order to get quality. Now, you also work inside of a very fast-paced, high-growth startup environment where you guys, there's a lot of demands on you. I think you told me about a data analyst that you've been looking for over the last 12 months and hired and interviewed 80 plus people and didn't find it until you found the one, but you did. Now, I know over the last 12 months, there's probably an infinite number of problems that you would have loved to have solved if you had somebody in the seat who maybe could have done most of it. So how do you rationalize the time that you spend sacrificing for to find that absolute right fit with the pace that you have to run inside of a company that has demands going every single day?
I always believe that top employee, like A or A plus employee, is like much better than an average employee. I think Mark Zuckerberg earlier said that one developer, a great developer, is like 10x better than like average developer. I think marketing is like much impactful because people make go above and beyond. So that is a challenge for me mostly. Like, to your point, yes, we were looking for a data analyst. And after 80 candidates, we couldn't find that person. We couldn't offer that position. And what happened was, because I was able to work on that, I used my time, sacrificed my time to help in that position. It wasn't a like no function at all. I use my like evenings and weekend to fill that position. It was like tough 12 months for me for that period, but now we find a very good person. So because, again, I'm lucky because I work all these roles, I can always fill in whoever is missing, so I fill that role. But now we are very happy. What could have happened if we hired a C player like 4 months ago was that we'll be like spending so much time to bring him to speed, and then it will not be the like on par. So I think 12 months is like nobody wants to wait 12 months, but I still think we are doing the right thing, waiting the right one person people. We call that A or A plus players. And then that person is going to have us no problem. And then this person actually started in April and he already goes above and beyond. Like everything I was trying to do last 3-4 months, he did like much better than I have done because he is a domain expert. I always also believe that I need to hire people who are smarter than me in those that they expertise. And this person happened to be that one. I'm so grateful. It was a tough 12 months for that one, but I'm happy that we ended up hiring one of the best data analysts in probably in US or Canada.
Key thing I heard you say there was, I made the choice. My choice is to sacrifice my time and substitute in and play a pinch hit role in some of these areas so that I can buy time to find the right person rather than find the right person and sacrifice everybody's time as a result of them not being as optimal or as up to the task as the rest of the team. Is that fair?
Yes. That's very fair. And then it's a like decision that I have taken. I know some people might have said, let's get a C plate and let the ball rolling. But in my experience, I don't want to be perfectionist, but I want to make sure to deliver as much as possible. I want to make sure that the quality stays in that top level because I don't want to also like reduce the quality of the team members because now everybody went into the, like very extensive, like almost McKinsey type consulting case studies to solve these things. I don't want to pick like a C level person to reduce the quality because then people will say like, John, why did you hire this guy? So I want to make sure that we keep that quality. And then if I have to work a little bit more extra hours, let it be.
Got it. Cool. Making the trade-off. I love it. All right, John, last question here. Let's say that you could go back in time and sit down and have a conversation with your younger self, but you know everything you know today about the transition that you've made from engineering to marketing to leadership and now VP of marketing and all the wonderful hiring practices, OKRs, everything you've had experience with, you know today. And you could sit down with your younger self, perhaps maybe in some of those early NVIDIA days, and have a conversation and share some advice. What advice would you share with your younger self?
Yeah, I will probably say, keep up the good work. NVIDIA is a great company. Maybe I would have said like maybe stay a little bit more at NVIDIA because after I left NVIDIA, stock prices increased tremendously. I'm glad that I kept all my stocks, but that was my first advice to John at NVIDIA. Dude, stay like 2 or 3 more years, get more stocks, and then you can leave. That was my first advice. But I think your question is that in terms of leadership, I think my biggest advice will be that think about some long-term planning and vision because at that time I was thinking about, it was my first leadership position, I was trying to make sure my projects are done and then I execute. Let's say we have a certain amount of GPUs we have to sell, I was thinking about that one. I wasn't thinking about what can be the next generation of, let's say, GPU test drive, that program I was running, or what kind of forecasting I should have done, or what will be my vision. So I was thinking about like shorter-term plans. So that will be my advice. Stay with NVIDIA, that's going to be great stock returns, and then do some long-term plannings and create some vision for the like next generation of the projects.
Love it. The 80-20 or the 20-20 vision on hindsight with regards to stock is always a valuable one. So I totally appreciate that. I probably would have given myself that advice in a few places, but awesome. All right, John. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking leadership with you today. OKRs, getting to learn how you've made them successful and how your organization has taken them to the next level, getting higher mid 90% accuracy on executing those every quarter is absolutely wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing your stories, your expertise, and your wisdom with us. And I look forward to hearing about all the incredible things you and the team at Natomi are going to do.
Thank you very much, Nils. And thanks again for inviting me and having me here today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the B2B Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd welcome you to subscribe and give the show a 5-star review. You can see the show notes and all of the resources mentioned in today's episode at b2bleadershippodcast.com. As always, I'm Nils Vinya, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Take care and have a great rest of your day. This podcast is brought to you by the B2B Leaders Academy. The cost of not consistently developing your leadership skills is enormous, and the B2B Leaders Academy features monthly leadership training and live coaching. Being a great leader isn't hard. You just need a guide and the right set of tools. So head on over to b2bleadersacademy.com to join and become the leader you have always wanted to be.